Welcome to a special episode of JAT Cast. My name is Dr. Chris Coons, and I'm the Associate Editor for Digital Applications at the Journal of Athletic Training. Today, we're going to rebroadcast an event that we recorded with Dr. Zachary Kerr from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, back in August of 2018. I just wanted to give you a quick editorial note before we start the episode. During the recording of this episode with Dr. Kerr, we ran into some audio issues early in the recording, and it'll be pretty obvious to you as a listener of the podcast. We just wanted to apologize for that, and we've tried to do our best to reduce the impact of that on the overall experience. We hope that you enjoy the podcast, and we also hope that you rate and follow us on Google Play, iTunes, or Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts from. Thank you very much.
So, hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us. Whether you're East Coast, West Coast, somewhere in between, or somewhere in Alaska or Hawaii, speaking of Hawaii, I actually was born and raised in Hawaii, and I sort of made my way east to North Carolina via school. So I did my undergrad at the University of Washington, went out to The Ohio State University for a couple masters, and went to North Carolina to do my PhD in epidemiology. And a lot of that was based upon discovering sports injury research through Dr. Don Comstock, who is actually the principal investigator of the High School Rio Injury Surveillance Program, which is featured in this series of publications. And when I was at UNC, I got a lot of experience working with sports injury surveillance data and data collected through the Center for the Study of Retired Athletes, Matthew Gefeller Traumatic Brain Injury Center. But one of the things I got exposed to there was the NCAA Injury Surveillance Program. And there was an opportunity for me to go with the NCAA and the Daedalus Center to become the director of the NCAA Injury Surveillance Program. And I told myself, you know, coming fresh out of graduate school, just getting my PhD, this was an opportunity I couldn't pass up. I wanted to take what I learned in public health and sports injury research and really learn more about the field, learn about the work that is done by sports medicine professionals such as athletic trainers, and be able to talk with the stakeholders that matter at the collegiate level. So pack things up from Chapel Hill, move to Indianapolis, Indiana, right in the middle of the 2014 polar vortex, and staked my claim in Indianapolis for a few years before looking back at other academic possibilities, and lo and behold, I'm back in Chapel Hill and entering my third year as an assistant professor in the Department of Exercise Sports Science. So it's been a great journey, and I just kind of stop and think. Today was the first day of school at UNC Chapel Hill, and I think back to entering the undergrad at the University of Washington in the fall of 2000. Not even being 18, I was actually born a little later, and just thinking like I don't know what I'm doing, and just fast forward 18 years later and just kind of astonished thinking about what I've done and all the good peers and friends from that network that I built, what they really mean to me. So I'm greatly appreciative of it all.
Thanks for the introduction, Zach. Would you be able to give us a little bit of background about the process of revising these papers, who you've been working with throughout the process, and sort of what the goals of the series of papers will be over the next year or so?
Yeah, well, you know, in all honesty, I can't take full credit for the work that has been done with the series. A lot of this comes down to 300 individuals, the first one being Don Comstock, who is the principal investigator at High School Rio, Tom Dompier, who is now a professor at Lebanon Valley College in their Department of Athletic Training, but who formerly was the president of the Daedalus Center, and Steve Marshall, who is the director of the Injury Prevention Research Center and a member of the faculty in the Department of Epidemiology at UNC Chapel Hill. And this is something that we had discussed doing since I was a doc student back in 2013. You know, to give full credit to Steve, this was initially Steve's dream that he wanted to accomplish, that he wanted to have another series of special manuscripts come out related to injury surveillance program at the collegiate level. In 2007, a series was done with the help of many different co-authors, But if you look at the publications, it was Steve Marshall, Randy Dick, and Julie Eagle who really led the charge for these papers. And Steve wanted to commemorate that work by doing another series, this time including the high school Rio injury surveillance program, because that had come into fruition in 2005. And it was also at the same time that the NCAA injury surveillance program went to an online interface. So the 2007 special issue was all pen and paper forms from all the way back to the 80s to the 90s to the early 2000s. And we really wanted to commemorate this first decade of web-based sports injury surveillance that was occurring both at the NCAA and the high school level. So it was a very huge undertaking. You're going to see 14 papers, a couple editorials coming out, and this was a four-year endeavor that started at UNC, continued while I was with Daedalus Center and working as the NCAA Injury Surveillance Program Director, and finishing during my first few years at UNC Chapel Hill. And you'll see the names of the co-authors as the papers come out, and definitely want to praise them for all the hard work and efforts they've done to making sure these papers were the topmost quality.
From multiple athletic trainers this week, is they were wondering why an athletic trainer should be interested in injury surveillance that's presented in this way, and what do you think an athletic trainer can get from these series of papers that will actually help them in their clinical practice?
Yeah, my hope is that a lot of the data is going to help inform the clinical practice of athletic trainers in a couple different ways. First of all, these data are providing a huge sample of other schools, other programs that may be similar to those settings that those athletic trainers who are reading these materials are working in. And my hope is that they're able to look at these data and sort of compare where they stand, where their school stands. If they're finding that injury rates are lower than what's presented in the findings, then they can go to their athletic directors and say, this is the value of me. This is the value of having an athletic trainer. We are doing better than what we're seeing in these nationwide samples from the NCAA or the high school Rio. At the same time, if they find that the rates are higher, it may be good motivation to then get them to show the data and say, we need more help. We need additional hands on deck to be able to provide the care and drive down the injury rates that to the levels that we're seeing in the nationwide survey. From another standpoint, the schools are going to benefit from participating in these surveillance programs. It's going to enhance the quality of student athlete healthcare by providing these data on injuries and illnesses as they relate to sports participation. At the same time, these sites do, High School Rio, the Daedalus Center, they do provide access to the data, help inform injury prevention practices. The Daedalus Center does have many publications and many opportunities for authors to conduct their own studies using the data set. High School Rio has study reports available on an annual basis that you can go and obtain the findings from, the statistics. I think it's also an altruistic endeavor as well when you participate in sports injury surveillance, because you're not only providing data that will help your own institution, but you're also providing data that's going to help the entire body of athletic trainers who need that national data to compare where they are, as previously mentioned. So my hope with surveillance is that it continues to drive the discussion related to the injury prevention needs that we need and the successes that we've seen thanks to the work of sports medicine professionals such as athletic trainers.
And so on that same note, in sort of making these papers applicable and accessible to athletic trainers, that's really the goal of publishing in the Journal of Athletic Training and making this related to high school and collegiate sport, which is where we do a lot of our best work. We often hear methodologically or statistically, reading the Journal of Athletic Training can be challenging for some athletic trainers. It's sometimes statistics or methods heavy. The discussions are often not as directly applicable to clinical practice as individuals would like. And as a researcher, I get caught in that trap all the time. I totally understand. I was wondering, since we're really here to talk about the methods paper, can you just provide a little bit of an overview of the way that data are going to be presented in these papers and how athletic trainers might be able to even if their statistics background isn't as strong as they would like it to be able to interpret the evidence in order to understand what is being presented?
Yeah, great question. It's such a difficulty dealing with these large data sets, you know, thousands of injuries. You know, the High School Rio has been around for a decade. They have over 15,000 injuries logged. The NCAA Injury Surveillance Program has probably been longer than I've been alive, to be quite honest. I think it was started, you know, piloting in the early or late 70s and really introduced formally in the early 80s. I think, yeah, months before I was born, and I'm no spring chicken. I think the struggle we have as researchers is trying to find a way to take it back to the clinicians and thinking about what a clinician who's on the forefront of this needs. And I think the one thing that helps me personally as a researcher is that when I always think about writing the discussion, I always think about what does this mean, not only for research directions, but also clinical applications. Because a journal such as the Journal of Athletic Training needs to have a priority focused on that. And that is one thing I see happening, where we have to focus on what sort of clinical applications can apply from this research. And I think the editorial board has really done a good job in the past few years and even before with trying to emphasize that. You know, I can't say that I wouldn't be thinking about this with the help of Dawn, without the help of Dawn, because she really pushes that. But one person who has been especially helpful as I think about these things is my former colleague at the Daedalus Center and former cohort member with the Department of Epidemiology, Karen Ruse, who's now assistant professor at Cal State Long Beach. And, you know, we would always write papers and she would always get back to me and say, and she still does to this day, you know, think about what would Dawn say? What's the clinical application to this? What does this data mean that will matter to athletic trainers who aren't researchers but practicing on the field? And that's something I always try to think about. And I try to do when talking about these data. But I know a large tangent to your question, but I just kind of want to talk about some of my research philosophy and some of the support I have in thinking to that ultimate goal. But for me, I really wanted to have the data laid out in tables to be able to give individuals a number so they can actually see the actual proportions and the distributions of the data. And the data are provided in a manner that's been similar to some of the work that I've done in my publications with the NCAA Injury Surveillance Program. So a lot of the tables, if you're familiar with my work through JAT, you'll notice a lot of the same structures where it's really distributions in practices, distributions and competitions stratified for individuals looking at the high school level versus looking at the collegiate level. We try to provide as much data as possible related to those, as well as rates with the 95% confidence intervals and just as many options so that any athletic trainer who is really interested in what's happening with ankle injuries, they could go to a table and find how it works or what the data are saying for specific settings and specific types of events within those settings. The great thing about the methods paper that is out now is that it does kind of give a layout of all the different types of tables that are available. And we tried to structure them similarly across all 12 to 13 papers.
So I was reading a paper today about NFL Achilles injuries or something like that, looking at kind of temporal spacing of those injuries over the last six seasons or something like that. And they broke it down not only by game and practice, but also phase of the season. So preseason injury versus in-season versus postseason. Will that type of information be available in some of these papers?
Yeah, great question. Yeah, there will be a breakdown of the time at which the within the season that the injuries are taking place. So preseason, regular season, postseason. There are methodological considerations to consider when it comes to these data. So for the NCAA injury surveillance system and for High School Rio, we rely on a measurement of at-risk exposure time. So the time at which an athlete could get injured, and thus data can be provided. And we utilize something called an athlete exposure. And that's really a way to get a good, valid measure of how much time they're exposed to potential injury, but without overburdening the athletic trainer by asking them to keep logs of how many minutes of play or hours of play, hours of practices that occur. You know, if you're a football athletic trainer and you're being asked to keep logs for, you know, the average 110 players at the NCAA level, I just don't think it's doable. And I've heard stories about certain people saying, oh, the athletic trainers are lazy, but I don't think I know an athletic trainer who falls in that category. They all work their butts off. Just asking them to do more above and beyond that, I think it gets really difficult in the spectrum of what we're trying to have them collect for surveillance purposes. High School Rio, on the other hand, doesn't have athlete exposures collected per time and season, whereas the NCAA does. So with the NCAA, you can get those time-specific rates. With High School Rio, you won't be able to. You'll be able to get distributions, but, hint, hint, most injuries are occurring in the regular season simply because there's more exposure time in the regular season. But if you're looking at rates, we're typically finding at the collegiate level that the rates are higher in the preseason, and that can be due to a number of different reasons, such as competition within the squads as they compete for starting positions, lack of fitness as they're coming back into the season, and many different other factors.
So you brought up a great point during that response, and I'm wondering, time is a huge limitation for athletic trainers on a day-to-day basis. In general, we struggle with finding time to eat lunch, let alone log person hours or exposure hours or whatever else we might be trying to do. So I'm wondering, from a Rio perspective and from an NCAA injury surveillance perspective, what are some of the steps that both of those organizations have taken to minimize the burden on the reporting athletic trainer and to promote or recruit athletic trainers to actually participate in logging their injuries and exposure data?
Yeah, at the NCAA level, the Data Center has worked very hard to ensure that everyone has access to the possibility of providing surveillance data. Schools with certain electronic medical record systems, those schools that have those EMRs that are already pre-certified with Datalist have the ability to simply do their daily clinical work with the EMRs as they are and are likely doing, and with the click of the button are able to provide data. The only additional thing they would have to do is collect the aggregate head counts of how many individuals were at a practice or at a competition to generate the athlete exposures. For those individuals at the high school level, if they're thinking about High School Nation, which wasn't included in this study but is another viable option for participation surveillance, or even at the NCAA level, if there's not an EMR, I know some schools are still doing paper and pencil data keeping, but if they wanted to go to an EMR, Datalist does provide a free bare bones EMR as to not compete with the vendors who are providing a lot of free time and labor to get certification for the purposes of surveillance. But those options are available as well. At the High School Rio level, there are strengths and benefits to that as well. For many high school athletic trainers, there may not be EMRs that are with budget. So as with Datalist and High School Nation, High School Rio can provide sort of a surveillance program tool that can track their injuries and provide reports. At the same time, the athletic trainers have access to the study reports to be able to get an idea of how their data compared to the other schools participating. And in some cases, there are incentives involved with participation in High School Rio. And a lot of that information can be found on the High School Rio website. So definitely strengths and weaknesses to consider for surveillance at the high school level. There are a couple of different options. And I should note that I believe, and probably the folks from AT still could probably provide more information, but they do have AT PBRN as well, and a surveillance component is that. Full disclosure, I don't know much as about that, perhaps as I should, but Tamara, Allison, Eric, the crew there at AT still are always very approachable and friendly, and I've never had any bad interactions with them whatsoever, and I'm sure they would be willing to answer questions if individuals are interested in working with them and their surveillance program.
So an important thing to consider whenever we're looking at a given paper or a series of papers are kind of strengths of the approach and balance those against some limitations or some weaknesses of the approach. And so whether it's an observational study in a lab environment, it's a field-based study, or it's a larger-scale epi study, every design, you know, there is no perfect study design, right? We all kind of learned that in day one of research methods. So I'm wondering, based on now having gone through the development of these papers and working with authors to put them together and get them ready for prime time, what do you think some of the prime strengths of your approach are, and what do you think some weaknesses or limitations that you knew going in, and some things that you kind of realized as you were working through the papers?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I can say this since I'm now no longer with the NCAA. But one of the things that used to drive me nuts when I talked with some of the stakeholders was that they always used to like to rag on participation. And I think there's so many efforts being done right now to continuously increase participation. But when you're talking about huge populations of schools and programs at the NCAA and high school, you're bound to have low participation rates. And getting a large number of high schools or colleges is very difficult. Multi-site studies are not easy. And to think about the fact that you can have these surveillance programs with 100 schools providing data, you're not going to find a data source bigger than that. So that is, I think, the biggest strength of surveillance. It's getting the max breadth of data possible from the largest number of schools. There's always going to be that one coach, that one person who's going to say, well, this doesn't represent me. But there's only so far that I can go when I go back and say, well, participate in surveillance then, you know, and represent those schools like you. And sometimes I get awkward looks. They don't know what to say, or they just walk off. But I'm a big advocate of, if you don't like the way surveillance is being projected, you have to have an active voice and participate and voice your concerns, because you're not going to get much out of just ranting and raving about it and not doing anything about it. Just, you have to be proactive and reactive as well to what we see. One of the limitations of surveillance is that there's only so much that surveillance can do. When you think about the work of Van Mechelen and the injury prevention sequence model, surveillance is one aspect of injury prevention, but it's really kind of that starting point where you're just getting the incidents, the who, what, where, and when. It gets a little bit more difficult to think about risk factors or the etiological aspects of an injury. And you can sometimes do that, but other cases, there's times where us as individuals working in surveillance, we get a little uncomfortable because we ask ourselves, is this really what surveillance was meant to do? Is it meant to go beyond just descriptive and very basic comparative analyses within the data? I guess now that I've been doing a lot more work outside of just surveillance and some of the basic descriptive epi, that's really been a lot of the work that I have done just to get the data out there. I've been thinking about this really critically, just saying, you know, is there more that I can be doing than just descriptive epi? Don and I have had this conversation a couple of times, but we always kind of fall back to the idea of, you know, is that there's nothing more you can do with surveillance other than that, and what are the limitations? And I think the more I talk with people, the more I'm willing to sort of explore that. It's sort of like I'd rather find something potential with limitations that can sort of be a stepping stone to yield those more etiologic studies, those more refined, smaller sample data with better statistical and methodological control, than just saying, nope, we just can't do this for surveillance. I'd rather surveillance sort of be a stepping stone, maybe the tip of the iceberg that propels us to explore more what's underneath it.
Yeah, I think that makes total sense. It's really hard to evaluate the scope of the problem and to understand what resources should be put towards if we don't understand either which sports or which injuries are resulting in greatest time loss and greatest healthcare burden. So that makes a lot of sense. We got a question that I think goes nicely off of that. And an athletic trainer is wondering, what types of data do you think are most helpful to bring to an administrator or to a stakeholder as an athletic trainer that would either advocate for the athletic trainer's worth or necessity in a way that a stakeholder is more likely to be engaged with the discussion? You know, often you bring a a rate of, we had 5 ACL tears last year, so we need more help. And that's not a very compelling message for an athletic director. Is there a way to frame that in a more effective way?
Yeah, I think it's if you have national data that can show, you know, on average, here are how many athletic injuries related to the ACL do occur, and you're able to compare that to a larger sample, then it's putting that 5 ACL tears in context. It's providing a picture of what's going on in this school versus what's going on everywhere else, and using that data as something you can pull out of your pocket to really emphasize that disparity going on in your school versus another school. You know, there's some work I've done in JT with concussions from Steve Broglio's concussion special issue. And it was that discussion about, you know, it's not just about what the data are, it's how you present the data. And this paper looked at so many different ways you could describe concussion incidents using the same data. You can describe it as the risk. What's the probability that, you know, someone on the team is going to get injured? The rates that we see a lot in injury surveillance studies, or even just the proportion of people, are the proportion, the average number of injuries that occur within a season with on a team, as well as looking at aggregate data as far as what percentage of teams within a large cohort had a certain type of injury incident occur. So there are so many different ways that you can cut the data. As well as there are so many different ways that you can talk about the data and how it reflects things. And I think that's kind of the strength and the limitation of data. It's, you can have it tell your own story. The tricky part is you can have it tell your own story, and you can make it biased based upon your own values and your own things and your own agenda that I guess you're trying to set. So I think the best thing I try to tell people is that it's important that you choose that story, but you kind of go in saying, I'm going to look at this a priori. I'm going to make decisions prior to actually searching for the data, and think about, after you find the data, what does that mean and why is that possible, versus doing it the other way. There's a lot of issues, I think, with, you know, letting the tail wag the dog, so to speak.
Yeah. So what are some areas in and around sports injury epi that have resulted in or understanding the epidemiology around specific injuries or specific injuries in populations that have actually resulted in policy changes in the last decade, say? Are there some good examples out there that might you know, help clarify some of this for clinicians?
Yeah, I know, you know, we don't talk about professional sports data surveillance, injury data surveillance, partially because it's a lot harder to get your hands on. But at that point, it's not really a convenient sample because they're getting data from all the teams. It's a census. But a lot of rule changes that happen at the NFL within the NBA are based upon the injury incidents that occurs within the previous seasons. So when we talk about kickoff rule changes, that's related to the NFL injury surveillance program that occurs. And a lot of it comes down to what happens in the NFL, then trickles down to the lower levels. But the NCAA uses the injury surveillance program to help identify areas of need, to help identify the incidence of injury. When I was an employee at Datalist, I had a lot of rules committee meetings with the coaches and just checking in with them about what issues matter to them and what sort of things we should be examining. And we would get emails related to, you know, we want to know what injuries are related to this sort of activity. Donna's told me with High School Rio that the National Federation of High Schools, NFHS, a lot of times during their meetings would ask questions about what's the incidence of injuries at this time point. And she would have her staff there present, whip up the numbers there for them to investigate. So there's a lot of data-driven decisions at many levels of sport and within many different organizations. I think for me, the difficult part is that I think once a decision is made, a rule is implemented, there's no more evaluation. There's no outcome evaluation to see how it's actually affected the actual incidence of injuries. And that's part of the Van Mechelen sequence of injury prevention, is that you go back to surveillance to see longitudinally what the change is. There's no examination of process evaluation. There's no examination of the compliance or the actual implementation. and there's no examinations of what happens in the communities that may have less privilege, less opportunities. Because let's be honest, I mean, a lot of research happens in our own backyard, and us as college professors, our backyard are typically well-to-do, suburban, our college campus, high socioeconomic status places. And, you know, it's easy for me to spout, you know, you got to go out to the lower socioeconomic status communities, but they're hard to find. And you need to have a lot of buy-in. You need to build a lot of trust with those communities. And I think that's kind of the things that I think about now when I think about surveillance, is that I'd like to be able to find ways to sort of look at injuries in those communities and find ways to help minimize that health disparity gap that we really have created just because of our access to certain different communities for research. And, you know, again, I'm preaching a lot. I'm getting on my pedestal, and I completely understand how, you know, with research, it's a matter of who's available, what's feasible. And it's just, it's always in the back of my mind of trying to figure out a way of how can I get buy-in or how can I get participation from different communities and get different voices participating to help make sure that we're watching out for them as well.
Yeah, that's not a problem in epidemiology only. I mean, I think that's across areas of research right now. We're starting to see the impact of socioeconomic status and both sex and gender and a number of other factors that haven't been considered nearly enough in across sports injury research. So,
yeah, I mean, pro equity research is something that we're slowly coming into thinking about. And I think there's just a lot of great researchers out there that work within our field, that work, that are athletic trainers that are thinking about this. I know the University of Washington is working with, Tamara Hunt down in Georgia Southern, I believe. I believe she's at Georgia Southern. But Tamara does an excellent job thinking about these issues. And Emily Crocious at the University of Washington, Sarah Crispin do a really good job thinking about pro-equity research. And funny story, I mean, I thought about this because I was at my friend's defense at UNC a couple of years ago, and he does tobacco research, but he does it with the cross-section of people of color and LGBT individuals. And he kept talking about pro equity research. And I just kind of asked a question. I was like, well, what is this? How do I get started? How do we start thinking about this? And the funny story is that his partner accused me of making his defense all about me. So I said, well, I'll show you. I'm going to do a study on this in the sports context. And Emily and I looked at implementation of heads up football for USA Football, and we got Joseph on the paper as well, my friend. And when it was published, I sent it to Justin. I was like, you make sure you show Justin that. Make sure that's what happens.
We're running a little long. Do you have time for maybe two or three more, and then we'll call it an evening?
Yeah, not a problem.
Great. So it seems like for the majority of the research in these areas, you've predominantly collected exposures and then, you know, injury frequency or injury count type data. Are there other variables? Say we come back in another decade and you and I still have hair and we can do another one of these at some other point and all that stuff. Are there other variables that you would love to see collected in the next decade that would help really take a next step with this type of data collection and analysis?
Yeah, that's a difficult one. It kind of goes back to my thoughts about, you know, what is surveillance meant to do and how much can it do? You know, there has been a lot of discussion in the field about what variables we need or what are the best practices or what are the guidelines we should abide by. You know, one that recently came out that I've been talking about with some of my colleagues is one written by Carolyn Finch in the British Journal of Sports Medicine that talked about, you know, if we want to look at subsequent injury, what sort of things should we make sure our research studies include as worthy variables? And, you know, it was pretty much six things. I agreed with them. But there's always a part of me that wonders if we bring out these guidelines about what are the best practices, are we basing them on what we know based upon the research we do with our communities? And as noted, it's our communities are usually well-to-do. They're in areas with more resources. And I wonder if we impose these guidelines on individuals working in harder reach communities, are we just making it harder for them to publish because someone can easily say, nope, they didn't abide by these guidelines, even though there may be a valid reason why they couldn't do it. It may be something as simple as just there's human data subjects concerns, to something as broad as there's just not the resources available for it. And that's something we think about with the work of KSI and just looking at the density of athletic trainers available. So I think I'm open to discussion about what variables are considered for the future, but I think we have to think very carefully about what sort of unintended consequences we can have by really pushing those or mandating them or saying that these have to be included on any study. And you know, I don't mean to say that, you know, Carolyn Finch is someone who thinks about this. So, you know, I'm sure she's well aware of this as well. If she's watching this, she's probably going to give me a lot of crap when I see her in a few months. But I mean, I think the work, you know, I think of these editorials as discussion points. But I feel it's very important to always think about, you know, what does this mean in the long term for consequences unintentionally as related to data collection. So I'm kind of walking around your question.
Okay. That's all right. There's always one or two artful dodges. Even Jay was guilty of that a few weeks ago, so that's okay.
It would have been more artful if I didn't just say that I was doing that. Yeah, but, you know, too late.
So given the fact that about 40 million kids between the age of 6 and 12 participate in sports, but are often not involved in highly structured sport environments like a high school or a college setting, are there efforts in place to try to start tracking similar data in younger populations? And I mean, I think there's some obvious barriers to that, but has it been attempted, or are there thoughts that it should be attempted?
Yeah, I know, you know, when I think of middle school injuries, I think of there are some studies. Glenn Beachy did one in JAT about 4 years ago that looked at, I think it was Punahou Middle School, one middle school in Hawaii in 20 years of data. I think there's another individual, I'm pretty sure I'm butchering their name, Mitchell Rau. The name I recognize, I'm not doing the name justice, but they did another study looking at middle school football. There is some youth football. Daedalus has done a lot of work with injury surveillance in youth football through the partnership with USA Football. The one I can think of firsthand, and full disclosure, I am I'm working part of the working team, but it's a group out of George Mason University with Shane Caswell and some of his colleagues there. But it's called ACHIEVES, and Shane's going to kill me because I cannot remember what the acronym stands for. ACHIEVES stands for something, but it's I don't know what it is offhand, Shane. I'm sorry. But the idea is it's looking at underserved, underrepresented individuals at the middle school level. And one of the components is doing injury surveillance. So we have data for 3 years looking at a couple different sports. We had a paper come out looking at middle school concussions published earlier last year. We just submitted something for middle school football. But the data are really interesting just when you look at how it compares to the high school or the collegiate level. We're finding that, you know, I think the practices are a lot more put place athletes more at risk for injury than they do at the collegiate or high school level. I'm not saying that the rates are higher. It's just when you look at that ratio of competition to practice injuries, that it's much smaller. So it's making me worry that there's more things going on that are injuring the kids in practices than we would see with that ratio we're used to seeing at high school or collegiate levels. But again, this is one sample of 9 middle schools. My hope is that there's a lot more discussion occurring based upon seeing more surveillance about how to get these programs started, how to do them at manageable costs, because they aren't cheap. I mean, the cheapest programs I know still cost a lot of money with a number of zeros behind that budget. But I think just having the conversations and trying to think of ways. One thing I will say also is that I think there's a lot of phone apps, a lot of private companies that are very willing to partner with researchers to sort of help solve this problem. And I think there's nothing wrong with trying to start that conversation with those organizations. Many of those organizations have athletic trainers involved, people who went through athletic training programs and who are certified involved as well. So I think there's just more discussion that's going to be happening as we start thinking about this question, because Chris, yeah, you aren't the first person to ask that question. I'm sure you won't be the last one.
Absolutely. So last difficult question, then I'll ask you a layup before we disconnect. So Matt Harkey sent in this this tough one. He was at the Museum for Science in Boston recently, and there was a display there about sports injuries and concussion risk. And the question posed by the exhibit was, should sports with high concussion rates be banned for athletes younger than 14 years old? So kind of getting back to our middle school question here. And so he was wondering, of course, he's going to put you on the spot with a really tough question. Based on what you know from the epidemiological data and from some of your other work in concussion, what are your thoughts on some of the discussions and arguments that are going on in the popular media right now about, you know, removing kids or removing parts of practices or specific fundamental skills from sports at a certain age in order to prevent early concussion?
Okay, yeah. First off, Matt, you owe me a beer in Vegas in June. but, you know, this is something that comes into play. And I think there's a couple of different things to consider. One, media interpretations of research can be correct as much as they can be incorrect. A recent study out of Harvard found that the media sometimes doesn't do the best job of reporting scientific studies. And I think sometimes it could be just they lack the understanding. And I think that's partially our fault as scientists. We need to find better ways to communicate our findings and make sure that we're providing information that's factual and correct for them. But in reality, I always tell my students, research is like a horrible game of telephone, going from truth and dealing with the error that comes with truth through measurement, and then moving on towards the writing, the process of publishing, getting into the 3,000 words for some journals, getting reviewers telling you things you need to do. And sometimes they're like, all right, I'll do this just so I can get the damn thing published. And then having, you know, the media talk about it, and then going all the way to social media where, you know, your grandma is posting something on Facebook about what are your thoughts about M&Ms causing cancer. And you're like, what? You know, when I think about the media response to concussions, I think there's a huge agenda that's being set. And there are differences in how certain members of the media portray this issue. But I think it's also the same in the research realm. There are different levels of comfort people have with saying there is something going on with concussion as related to adverse outcomes. And by nature, me as an epidemiologist, I'm going to be on the conservative side saying we need to have more research out there. That a lot of the research that is out there are small sample sizes, they're case studies, they're case series, and case studies and case series can't show causality or even association. All they can do is help us generate hypotheses that can be accomplished with those much stronger study designs. And I don't feel we're there yet. I feel there's more research that has to be done. However, there are people that say, you know, one of my friends is a health behavioral person, and he says, this is what you epidemiologists like to do. You always like to cast out because you never want to take credit when you're wrong. So be it. But I think, you know, my last concern, because I'm talking too much again, and I know people want to get to bed, especially on the East Coast, but there are discussions of the Haddon counter matrix of, or it's the Haddon list of countermeasures. So it talks about what is the most severe thing we can do to stop outcome from occurring, to what are the least severe. And it kind of goes from most severe, banning the thing in general, all the way down to more tertiary prevention, managing things. And the idea of this is to help individuals think about what's that good compromise between finding something that will be effective, but also will be feasible to implement. So, you know, when we talk about gun control, the most rash, or not rash thing, because I actually agree with this, is that we should ban guns. But at the more minimal level, it's about if someone does get shot, that there's immediate on-site care that can help prepare for that. So with concussions and banning youth sports, I worry we're at the most severe option of banning sports altogether. And I feel like there's so many different options as we move down that countermeasure list that you can consider. And some of them are already being implemented, some of these prevention projects, prevention interventions. And we just need to do more research on them. And I know it's really hard getting this funding. You know, the work I did with USA Football was funded by USA Football, and there's always that perception of conflict of interest related to that. And, you know, my advice is always, you know, find someone who will study it, who takes out the independent concern of the dependent issue related to the funding. You can read the papers, you can find what the methodologies were. And if someone can find a finding that is a much stronger is from a much stronger study than mine, then I'm going to be the first one to say, you know, great, I feel more confident and comfortable with their findings versus mine. Because that's what research is meant to do. It's meant to build upon the work of others, find ways to find improvements and minimize limitations and go from there.
Great. Yeah, it's there's no right answer on these questions, but it does seem like there's big swings that are not necessarily backed by any supporting evidence or even by critical thought in some cases. So, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. The last thing I wanted to ask is when should we expect these papers to be coming out? What's kind of the timeline? What are some of the first ones that will be released so that people can kind of get ready for their notifications to pop up and be ready to engage?
Yeah, you know, talking with Craig Denegar, you know, we decided to go with something different from the one special issue that came out in 2007. We wanted to make sure people had access that just weren't over inundated with so much data at one point, sort of like, oh, you know, what am I going to do with all this? I don't know where to start. So kind of having it go a couple articles each month, we thought would help kind of keep people talking about this and keep thinking critically about what we need to do for the next special issue that comes out in 10 years. What can we do to provide better data? And having that come more in batches would help kind of lead to more critical thought and hopefully good recommendations. I think the plan is we're going to have a couple articles come out in each issue. The methods paper is out now. I believe the field hockey paper is out as well. I have received a lot of proofs for the other ones, so they are coming down the pipeline. I think football is going to be the one that's next. We really wanted to focus on football, you know, one of the first papers to come out. Field hockey was just one that got done a little earlier, and it was pushed out to give people an appetite for what to expect. So just be on the lookout. I guess, you know, if you have a PubMed subscription for certain articles, you know, look out for those notifications.
Yeah, you can also sign up on the Journal of Athletic Training website for Table of Contents alerts. So that'll bring the Table of Contents each month directly to your inbox, which is even easier. So
that is much easier.
Yeah. So, Zach, I want to thank you for taking the time this evening. I'm sure everyone appreciated it. I certainly did. And we're looking forward to seeing these articles coming out soon. I just want to remind everyone to, if you leave questions or tweet at us with questions, I'm sure Zach would be happy to kind of take a peek over the next 24 or 48 hours to see if there's any additional questions that pop up that he might be able to answer, or I might be able to answer, or one of the other digital applications folks might be able to jump in and help with.
In all full disclosure, I don't do the Twitter.
Oh, and there you go.
I use Facebook for my side hobby, which is Eurovision Press. That's another story for another day. But all my friends know and are disgusted by it. You know, the best thing you can do is if you have a question, just don't hesitate to email me. You know, the email zkerr@email.unc.edu. But honestly, you know, if you Google my name, it sounds so haughty and stuck up. If you Google me, you'll find me. Just you know, there's two other Zachary Kerrs out there. One's a football player, obviously not me, and the other one's a transgender activist, a youth transgender activist. You know, they're not me, but you know, shout out to another member of the LGBT community with my name. So that's great.
That's great. And so the only other thing I wanted to mention is that we'll have another one of these events in September. And so look out on social media and other places for announcement of who and when that will be. And otherwise, thank you for your time. And we look forward to doing this again soon.
All right. Thank you. Real quick. Hi, Jeff Conan. You made me say hello.
Oh, perfect. Super.
Yeah.
All right.
All right.
Have a good night.
All right. Thank you, everyone.